First order of business this morning is the Pledge of Allegiance. Let's stand for the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The roll, please.
On the roll for the Climate Protection Committee meeting of March 22, 2017, Director Abe Koga, here. Director Joya, Director Haggerty, Director Hudson, here. Director Rice, here. Director Ross, here. Director Wagon Connect, here. Committee Vice Chair Sinks,
here.
Committee Chair Barrett, we have a quorum.
Wonderful, thank you. Next, we will take public comment on non-agenda items. And each speaker will be limited to 3 minutes. These are for items not on the agenda.
So may I call all seven at the same time?
Yes, please.
Okay. So Janet Stromberg, Jed Holtzman, Kate Leger, Lisa Chang Mason, Paula Baker, Kelsey Jones, and Kathy Deal. The podium is to my right.
Great, and if speakers could line up so we could make this efficient, I'm sure everybody would appreciate that.
And Mr. Chair, would you mind if I timed with my phone and then indicated by saying into the microphone?
Thank you.
Okay.
Please.
Good morning, committee members. Janet Stromberg from 350 Bay Area. I'm very happy to see you here today. I have to say right off the bat, however, we are a little disappointed that there's no staff update on the draft 2017 Clean Air Plan today, since it's such a critical moment in the Air District's history and such an ambitious effort that staff has put untold hours into. And we also, I will tell you, put untold hours into. We submitted a 30-page comment letter, and don't expect you all to read that in detail, but we would like it if you could read a little bit of it, maybe the first part. I just have two general comments here. One is that the plan includes the Air District's toolkit, but missing from that list is its role in CEQA analysis and mitigation. This is an important Air District role that should be highlighted in the plan, and added as a potential tool for action on emission reduction for all control measures, since greenhouse gas mitigation is now a standard part of CEQA analysis. I think as things move along, as more options become available, I think the Air District should actively be engaging in that, and I know that they are, so we would like to see it listed in the plan. We would also like to see regular and ongoing stakeholder engagement on the most important plan sectors that the Air District staff identified in the plan, namely stationary sources, transportation, buildings, and energy. We think a more robust effort needs to be made to engage nonprofit organizations and community stakeholders in these spheres that may not already be active in Air District matters, and we hope to see that as an element of implementation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Keasley Jones. It was read earlier as Kelsey Jones, but it's Keasley Jones. And I'm here just on my own behalf and representing as well my sons, who one in college back east, and my younger boy at Berkeley High. And I'm on the board of the Berkeley High School Development Group, which manages about $1 million a year in funds. And we grant money to the school, to the students, and to the teachers for the initiative they have. And so I have some connection with what's going on with people at the high school level and at the undergraduate college level right now. And climate change is just a critical issue for them. And I just want you to realize that they are not waiting. They are going like water wherever it needs to go. And they take this issue just as a life issue for them. It's critical to them. And I feel that I'm trying to represent them in the process of government's role in effecting change and addressing the problem. And I think that one of the things that really is important here is for this organization, this board, to be much more involved in engaging with people like students and all different organizations that are very, very involved and very, very concerned about what is happening with government to fix, address, ameliorate the problems. And I just noticed, I thought, okay, well, this is a plan that is looking ahead to 2050. And so if we say that's 33 years, okay, if we look back 33 years, where were we in 1984? And it's clear that people were looking at climate change back then and saw that there was an opportunity to do things in government to affect change. And yet there really has not been a lot that has changed since 1984 to really significantly address the issues in a way that I know young people now feel is critical. And so they're not going to wait. And I would just really love to see a better mechanism for engaging the efforts of this body in coordination with groups that are active all around the Bay Area, young people who are really dedicating their lives to it because they know that it's a critical issue for them, for their lives. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll note as the next speaker approaches that we recently had our YES conference, and my belief is that was bigger and more successful than ever. I couldn't attend. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Paula Baker, and I live in Berkeley. I've read the draft 2017 Clean Air Plan, and I'm really inspired by its vision. I wish it were much more widely known than it is. The plan outlines very important and ambitious goals, and ones that will require a lot of public involvement. I'm afraid the Air District's efforts at public engagement so far around the plan fall very far short of what's needed. The open houses this winter were nice, but insufficient to educate the public about the scope and nature of the challenge, what it's going to take to get us to 2050. There were no presentations at those meetings, just tables and posters, and they weren't well publicized. I wouldn't have known that they were happening at all if 350 Bay Area hadn't made sure I did. I know the Air District is capable of public outreach and engagement. You know, when there's a Spare the Air Day, I know it. Can this committee please make a much stronger effort to let the public know what you're trying to do, how you're trying to do it, and what we can do to help? We really want to be involved, and you really need us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kate Ledger, and I am an architect. I've been practicing architecture for 20 years as a green architect, really. And I came here actually to testify about the 2017 draft Clean Air Plan, and I'm sort of surprised that it's not on the agenda because it's a very complicated and ambitious plan, and it has a lot of components that are good but could be better. And if you guys are trying to implement it or vote on it in any time soon, I feel like it should have been here. I'm excited that you're going to hear from SPUR. I think that what they're suggesting about decarbonizing our buildings is really important as part of the plan to get there. I think there are a lot of other things that need to be looked at as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Sinks and directors. Thanks very much. Jed Holtzman, Senior Policy Analyst for 350 Bay Area. Since this committee last met in November 2016, a lot has happened on climate in the Air District. You have released a final draft of the 2017 Clean Air Plan, which is a first-in-the-nation multi-sectoral climate protection strategy and regulation plan, which sets the region off on its journey towards 2050. The draft plan was issued, comments were received, and I know that our members submitted probably about 250 letters. Our leadership submitted an extensive comment letter. I'm sure I know industry submitted letters. I don't know if other stakeholder groups did, but none of this is being mentioned in this committee meeting. And given that you haven't met since November and aren't going to meet again as scheduled until May, that seems like a great oversight. We heard in Stationary Source on Monday that this plan was being brought to the board in April. So I'm wondering if this is not coming to the Climate Protection Committee, what is the role and purpose of this committee? We really think that we need a meaningful public process on this. Certainly, we appreciate the opportunity to submit comments, and there's been several workshops, But now we're to the passage stage, and the idea that it's not going to be heard here before the board votes on it so that this committee and its members can make a recommendation is troubling to us. We would like to ask, I know the chair is not present, but we would like to ask for a meeting of this committee after the final version of the plan is released and before it comes to the board for passage so that this committee can be fully briefed and make its recommendation to the board. We believe that would need to be in April or May. The ongoing oversight of this committee over this plan, which I brought but didn't bring up to theatrically hold up, is very critical. It's very big, and your staff will tell you, and it is reflected in the plan, that even if we implement the plan in full, that we still will need to do a tremendous amount more than we can even envision today. So this is a huge undertaking. According to staff, the most extensive rulemaking ever undertaken by the Air District in its whole. And essentially, since this represents the Air District's climate action for the next several years and going forward and subsequent plans, this has to succeed. This is not just another endeavor of the Air District. This is the thing that will determine whether we have a metropolitan scale model that we can use as an example for other jurisdictions, which is something that the plan expressly calls out as a point of the plan. Obviously, if we do this just in the Bay, that's not solving the problem. We really want you, this committee, to be the oversight body of the climate regulation in this plan. If you are not overseeing GHG regulation at the Air District, again, our question is, what is the purpose and function of this committee? Because we would like, obviously, to utilize it. Thanks very much.
Good morning, committee, and Mr. Broadbent. It's nice to see you again. I am participating today with the 350 Bay Area group. I've just recently joined the group, partly because I'm a former EPA employee of 30 years and worked on their voluntary climate change and energy efficiency programs. And I just read in one of the numerous emails that I get every morning that the federal administration's plans to cut EPA by 31% would include eliminating the Energy Star program. And the Energy Star was one of the most effective voluntary programs that EPA had to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, we used to say, if everybody in the United States changed one light bulb to a CFL, you could take 4 million, that's the same as taking 4 million cars off the road. So it was very effective. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really encouraged that the district is taking the lead on this and will be creating a model that can be used by other regions throughout the country. We know that California and the Bay Area have always been seen as the leaders. And I hate to say it, but EPA, we have relied on you a lot, you know, to kind of bolster up what we were trying to do to be more effective. So people have mentioned how they believe the plan may be made stronger. They've also talked about the committee taking a more involved role, and I have to agree with those positions. And I just really encourage you to continue working on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kathy, you have to put your name on the, you have to say your name and for the record.
Kathy Deal.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lisa Chang Mason, and I live in Alamo, and I'm a physician. And I came to speak to you all several months ago in support of Tom Kelly's work with solar in schools. And we mentioned at the time that our San Ramon Valley Unified School District had a really, really wonderful solar program that has probably saved the district an estimated $5 million in the first 4 years of operation while reducing CO2 emissions by 18,000 tons. And, you know, since then, I've just been so dismayed at what I've been hearing from Washington, you know, about the rollbacks and environmental protections that have been proposed. And it seems that there's been this horrible kind of attack on science and scientists. you know, in probably in the name of trying to deny climate change. And throughout all of this, I was kind of, you know, feeling really happy that you guys existed, you know, which I didn't know before. And, you know, I guess I'm speaking today that I'm really hoping that you will take really bold, decisive action. I feel like you know, California has been such a leader in renewable energy, and it's been such a boon to our economy, and that to have really strong regulations on greenhouse gases can spur investment and innovation in that area and keep us as a leader in that area. I mentioned that my kids have been really inspired by their work on the solar project, and my daughter is doing her PhD in marine biology, and since then it looks like we've lost the Great Barrier Reef, you know, which is just horrible. And my son is studying engineering and really hopes to work in renewable energy. So on their behalf and mine, I'm really hoping for bold action on your part. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Teresa Hardy, and I'm here as a representative for the Berkeley League of Women Voters and also for the Sierra Club Energy Committee. And we're disappointed also that the 2017 draft plan is not on the agenda. There are organizations out there that really want to work with this process, and we look forward to more inclusion in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that concludes public comment on non-agenda items. I know that the Clean Air Plan was the subject of years of work and a lot of input from board members as well as the community. It was introduced to the full board in January. We've had a number of committees review it. We've taken a lot of public comment on it, including community meetings. So I think, I mean, for my part, I do think that we've put some considerable energy into it. And my belief is the full board is considering action on it in April. Jack, would you like to comment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Actually, and I want to just thank the folks from the public here today for their comments. As you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, we did just present it to you at your board meeting, your full board meeting, actually last week. We had the stationary source measures reviewed by the Stationary Source Committee on Monday. We plan to talk about the mobile source measures at the Mobile Source Committee next month. And you are reminding me that we also then reviewed it with you at your retreat also this year as well in January. So you'll notice that the item number 5 is the local government climate protection measures out of the plan as well. So there's it's been talked about in a number of committees. And we're dedicating the April 19th board meeting for you to consider and hopefully adopt this plan. It'll be a part of that meeting where we'll walk through for you and the public the proposed changes to the plan itself. And everyone will have an opportunity, obviously, to comment at that time as well. But we had thought that that's kind of the efforts that to walk it through the public process with the plan. And it's been fairly extensive. And I hope that answers your question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, and I know the advisory committee has taken a look at it and is having another meeting, if anybody's interested, on Monday, the 3rd of April, where we have some of the world's leading scientists helping us think about not only the GHG portion of it, but the full thing. This is not just about GHG reduction. This is really our clean air plan, which is encompasses toxins and other things as well. Any comments from anybody
else? And we did receive a lot of comments. I should just, my final thought for you is we did receive a lot of comments. We're in the process of still trying to compile and make some changes to the plan. Mm-hmm. So far, though, it's not like it's looking like we're changing necessarily direction, but we're frankly getting a lot of good ideas to bolster the plan further.
And when would we expect a final draft to be available for the public?
It'll be at a minimum about a week before the board meeting. If we can do it sooner, we will. I'd also like to just add that we appreciate the public coming and saying that they're interested in working on this with us, because it's going to really take all of us to do what we need to do collectively to make our progress on the climate goals and also on the health goals and the plan. So we're very encouraged that people are interested in participating with us in implementing this plan. That is going to be very key.
The plan is a plan, and then you actually have to do real work, right?
And that's up to
all of us.
We're coming to the committees does not stop with the plan either. I mean, we'll be hopefully working with partners on implementing the plan and keeping the committees updated on how that's going as well.
Director Rice?
Yeah, just a comment on that. So given that we haven't had actually too many climate meetings in recent months, and I'm not sure what the schedule is like going forward, it does seem to me that if I was out there in the public, I would look to the climate committee to agenda to see if there was something on it. So you may, if there's a way to note or on the website, or if there is a landing place or site to go directly from the Air District website that really keeps people up to date on the activity around the Clean Air Plan. I just, that might be helpful. But common sense would say go to the climate committee if you want an update on the Clean Air Plan, and yet it does appear in other committees as well. So some direction that way.
No, I understand the comment, but the plan is a comprehensive plan. It's not just climate plan. It's our air quality plan. It has all the measures for the stationary source side, the mobile source side. It's designed to be able to put a blueprint for how to achieve state and federal ambient air quality standards, also toxic air contaminants, how we move forward towards addressing disproportionately impacted communities. So it's easy to think it's just our climate plan, but it isn't. It's broader than that.
Director Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not a static document either. Just like not everything that is in the plan is fully executed, not everything that's executed was ever in the previous plan. So it is a guidance document, and we are certainly open to innovation and implementation of newer ideas as they arise and as we get a better handle on their efficacy toward our mission.
Thank you. Any other comments? I've appreciated it personally. I've extracted a couple of the slides when I've talked to school classes about climate change and what we can do. I think it's a important stake in the ground. I appreciated the speakers talking about the next generation and how passionate they are and concerned. So thank you all for contributing this morning. We'll move to item 3, approval of the minutes of November 17th.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain? That passes unanimously. We'll move to item 4, which has been replaced with spur report called Fossil Free Bay Area.
Yes, Chair Sinks and members of the Climate Protection Committee, this morning we are very pleased to have Laura Tam, who is the Sustainable Development Policy Director for SPUR, the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, and she'll be presenting SPUR's report, Fossil Free Bay Area. We're very pleased to have Laura with us this morning.
Thank you, Jean. Thank you, everyone, for having me. Just can advance the slides this way. That way. Thank you very much. I would like to echo the appreciation for the public commenters. I really appreciate hearing that people feel that this plan, the Clean Air Plan, this report aside, is as important as I think it is, and especially in the shrinking of the federal government's support for some of the things we want to see on clean air and climate protection and Bay programs and so much else. It really is so much of it is really up to us and the actions that we take in the next few years at the regional scale and at the local scale to do something about climate change and clean air. So I'm very happy to be here to present to you today a report that we've worked on over the last 2 years that some of the agenda items are mirrored in the Clean Air Plan, which we're pleased to see. We're trying to, with this report, establish a policy agenda to accelerate the transition away from carbon-based fuels and energy, and create a model for other urban regions to do so and to become more climate resilient in the process. So thanks to the Air District for inviting me. And my contact information will be at the end if anyone else wants to talk about this further. I should begin by saying that SPUR, for those who don't know, is a member-supported nonprofit organization. We support good planning and good government through research, education, and advocacy, and we have offices in San Francisco, San Jose, and Oakland. So with no further ado, I'll get into the heart of the report. And I should also say one more thing, which is a lot of the agenda in this report came out of things that we learned through the process of, I was on the Air District's Advisory Council for a year or so a couple years ago when we talked about the region's clean energy future. And a lot of the very good ideas that we discussed in that forum and with our speakers are also reflected in here. So I think the pathways, like the general pathway to our clean energy future, are there's a large agreement around it, and now we need to figure out how to actually do the work to implement that agenda. So here are this is the cutting to the chase, the sort of the essence of the report, the three big ideas that the report is organized around, and hopefully you all have copies if you want to read more details, and we'll get into that. But so first, we need to shrink fossil fuel.
We have, wait a minute, what'd you just, we have copies of what?
You have copies of the report, sorry, and that you can read. There, each of these is a chapter in the report. So, sorry. Sorry for the confusing.
I got to read this whole thing to get to this? Okay.
No, just listen for the next 10 minutes.
There's a quiz later on.
Sorry, that was a confusing side comment. This is the essence of the report that we organized three chapters around, plus an introductory chapter. And I'll go through most of the big pieces of content in the next few minutes. So, the first point is we need to consume less fossil fuel overall. We need to shrink fossil fuel usage through improving the efficiency of buildings and the transportation system. Second, we must make buildings and the transportation system run on electricity, which is pretty clean, getting cleaner, and of course must become so more so. Point number three, we must make electricity clean by adding significant amounts of renewable power supported by energy storage and a smarter grid, and by finding lower carbon fuel sources for those things that are hard to electrify, such as airplanes and freight trains. So our report covers 9 key strategies within these three chapters and includes 36 specific policy recommendations targeted at local government. So really, what can local government do to help address climate change and clean air? And there is so much, so I'll get into that. So this is my one graphic. This is the Climate Protection Committee, so I could have eliminated this slide altogether because you are all aware of the challenge of climate change and the fact that it is already here today. Global temperatures are rising. This is just showing the years going by and the months of the year and increasing towards that 2 degrees C safe guardrail of climate change that the world has agreed on and formalized in the Paris Agreement. So, of course, there with these changes and increasing heat in the atmosphere, there are a whole host of consequences for the Bay Area. Heat waves, water stress, sea level rise, and more. And those challenges, of course, are going to be even worse in places less able to cope than our region is. So fortunately, in the last couple of years that we worked on this report, the Paris Agreement was reached. We passed SB 32 to extend the benefits of AB 32. The cost of solar fell significantly, and there's much more that has advanced the goals we're all driving towards, and yet there is more we need to do. This chart should be somewhat familiar to you. The state and region, as you know, both have emission reductions goals of 80% below 1990 levels by 2050, which is considered pretty deep decarbonization. This air district chart that we use in our report shows that we hit our peak emissions in around 2000, and we are slowly reversing the trend. But we will not meet our 40% below benchmark in 2030 or our 80% below 1990 mark in 2050 without additional programs and policies and greater implementation of the policies and programs that we already have. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this chart. I think you're familiar that the stacked rainbow bars are the sources of emissions, and the black line is the goals. So, as you all know, again, another chart that this committee already knows, this audience already knows, it's not just for the climate and demonstrating leadership on climate change that we need to do this, but going fossil-free has very direct benefits for the Bay Area in terms of clean air. There are many parts of the Bay Area that have relatively high levels of long-term exposure to toxics, to fine particulate matter, ozone, or periodically exceed safe limits for these pollutants, or have higher levels of air quality-related adverse health outcomes like cancer and asthma. And this chart on the left just shows that in Alameda County, the asthma hospitalization rate for children is nearly twice the state average and the third highest in California after Imperial and Fresno counties. This is a chart showing sources and sort of sinks or uses. On the left-hand side, the blue bars, you see sort of the energy sources consumed across California. Of all energy, the state consumes the most fossil fuels in the form of petroleum. After that, it's natural gas. And then electricity is kind of unique because it's both a source and a use, which is why it's dark blue. But suffice to say, on the far right, you see the percentage of greenhouse gas emissions from each of the fossil fuels that we consume. The main thing that I want to show with this chart is that passenger vehicles are the largest source of fossil fuel use in the state. This is not for the Bay Area, sorry, this is just for the state of California. But it's important to know where our fossil fuels come, what the sources of fossil fuels actually are, and what their uses are. So our research in this report revealed three kind of key things. One, our electricity power portfolio is pretty clean and getting cleaner, especially relative to other places in the United States. Second, when you think about natural gas uses for industrial uses, for buildings, for heating, commercial buildings, it's the second largest source of GHG. And not that much is being done to consider how to reduce natural gas use or shift demand to non-fossil sources through electrification. And then, as I said before, transportation, true for California and even truer for the Bay Area, is the greatest and fastest growing source of fossil fuel use across all counties. This is our electricity portfolio of utility provided electricity. The green and yellowish colors reflect renewables. The blue things reflect non-California renewables but non-GHG sources. And then you have natural gas, a little bit of coal, and unspecified sources. So policy is going to continue to push this with the 50% renewable portfolio standard and the proposed elimination of nuclear within PG&E's portfolio in the next 15 years with a renewable energy replacement. That was just on the utility-provided side. We also have customers, people, wanting to do something about clean energy for themselves, and we have an exponentially growing rooftop solar. Annual installation in the 9-county Bay Area continues to skyrocket. This is an annual chart, not a cumulative chart. And PG&E, who participated in this project with us, said at the time that they were adding about 6,000 solar customers per month in their service territory. So that's an astounding change from the past. As I said before, passenger cars and trucks, the largest single source, responsible for 80% of all transportation emissions. Use has grown almost 20% over the last 25 years. We're going to decrease per capita VMT through policy. That's what Plan Bay Area is for. But we are also going to add 2 million people to the Bay Area by 2040. So we need to need to significantly offer alternatives to driving alone and reduce the emissions per mile of driving if we want to achieve a fossil-free Bay Area, not just reduce per capita VMT. And as you all know, we are in a state that has a very robust framework of climate policy and aims to reduce emissions 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. So we are in a fortunate place to really take the actions that we need to take. So I'll go through the policy agenda for the three big ideas I mentioned before, with the question, like, what can the Bay Area do to really accelerate our nation's, even the world's progress? How can we become a model for the rest of the world in terms of decarbonizing our region? So the quickest and least expensive way for the region to advance a fossil-free energy system is through efficiency. And we have two broad categories of recommendations in this area: improving efficiency of buildings and the equipment inside them, and then improving the efficiency of the transportation system by reducing the annual number of VMT. We recommend that local governments adopt REACH codes, such as CalGreen Tier 1 or 2, improve code enforcement and compliance improvement through identified best practices, experiment with voluntary outcome-based energy codes as a compliance pathway towards the zero net energy goals, which our state has adopted. And perhaps one of the more aggressive recommendations in our report is to ask local governments to require energy retrofits of existing buildings. Many of the buildings we already have are the buildings we're still going to have in 2050. So we recommend that local governments adopt mandatory energy efficiency retrofit requirements that have, there are a lot of flexible pathways to do this. They can include benchmarking, audits, time of sale, disclosure of building energy performance, and then sort of a requirement to implement identified cost-effective improvements. And lead by example with city buildings. That's another thing to do, or government buildings if it's not a city, perhaps a county. Local governments and even regional agencies, I know ABAG through the Bay Rent program has been doing this, helping to accelerate energy retrofits of those buildings that are challenged, that have unique needs such as affordable housing that may not be well served by the efficiency market. There have been some very promising whole building multifamily retrofit programs that have been piloted in the last 3 years by PG&E, Marin Clean Energy, and others. So we also have to address this issue of plug load, which is plugging in devices and the fastest growing use of energy within a typical household, and currently consumes about 2/3 of the average household's electrical load. It's an unregulated load. It's challenging. We've got to figure out experiment with ways to deal with that. This is a recommendation that is probably featured in every SPUR report since 1910. We would like to see less sprawl. We want to see more zoning codes that direct high-density housing and jobs into priority development areas, especially those within a quarter of a mile of transit stations and stops. As you all know, we have a plan for doing this. These are our priority development areas, which are more than 170 places designated by local governments that will absorb 80% of new housing and 60% of new jobs on less than 5% of the Bay Area's land. So we need to make it easier to build the housing that aligns with our goals in Plan Bay Area and protect existing open spaces, whether agricultural or natural lands, especially large contiguous areas that are contain high-quality farmland or ranch land or ecological habitat. We need to make infrastructure investments that improve walkability where this growth is planned to reduce driving by design. We recommend that MTC consider not funding new transportation projects that increase per capita VMT, and then we need to expand and increase bicycle networks between and within suburban and urban centers. We need to continue to invest in our transit network and make it great, especially as we add new people to the Bay Area. And retrofit the region's smaller neighborhood centers, not just downtowns, for walkability and bikeability. We can use policy and pricing tools to change people's modes of travel and travel preferences. We can eliminate minimum parking requirements, implement demand-based pricing, such as SF Park here. We can establish congestion-adjusted tolling for major highways, roads, and bridges in the Bay Area. We can implement an indirect source rule that can require new development to significantly reduce trip generation. We're trying trip caps in Mountain View. The advent of autonomous vehicles, of course, is something that everyone is really interested in right now. We have to find a way to make sure that those autonomous vehicles are electric, or we're all doomed. We have to come up with fleet policies that help to incentivize autonomous fleets to be electrified. Big idea number two is around electrification. After we reduce energy waste, it's time to take a look at the way that we burn fossil fuels and change them. Electrification means new technology, planning and investing in infrastructure. And we try to balance making recommendations around about specific technology with trying to letting the market and consumers pick what would work best, because this is a rapidly evolving field. We don't exactly know what to do. But we have some ideas about the buckets. So we talk a lot about reducing car use, and we still mean that, but there will always be some amount of driving, and we offer that all that driving should be electrified. So personal adoption of battery electric vehicles is actually growing in the Bay Area. We're we have some of the most electric vehicles of any place in the state. I think San Jose, the city of San Jose, is the number one in electric vehicles in all of the country. So we really have an opportunity to push policy with this. So we need to set up infrastructure to do that too, that remains flexible to changing cars and chargers and preferences. And there's lots of discussion groups that exist today to help try to stay on top of evolving technology and come up with ways to make buildings and parking infrastructure more flexible to accommodate the chargers and the equipment of the future. This is actually obviously not a building, it's a ship, but we have been very successful at electrifying hard to electrify things, such as our shore power program. We can do this with buildings, and one of the most encouraging technology options for doing this is the heat pump, which is far, far, far more efficient than the way we heat our buildings today. So there's a lot of barriers, though, including lack of awareness, a need for, it's not always suitable for every type of building. So we need to do a lot more education, pilot projects, and testing. And then reducing the fees that we tend to charge for trying new technologies, that seems to be a challenge in local building departments. New technology can be expensive to implement, but we want people to try it, and so we have to try to encourage experimentation. Finally, the energy generation that we build today is going to be with us for the next 20 to 40 years. And so we really need to make every choice fossil-free because it will have many more benefits and avoid stranding assets in the future. Renewables, of course, have been dropping in cost for a long time and are expected to be cheaper for both commercial and publicly owned utilities within 5 years relative to gas or cogeneration. So we recommend expediting the permitting and review of projects that propose to install solar, wind, and energy storage facilities, requiring buildings and major retrofits to put solar PV or hot water on their roofs. We have a good example of a better roof ordinance here in San Francisco we'd like to see copied. Building departments can collaborate with utilities to develop best practice in building codes, permitting, and fire risk reduction for energy storage facilities and renewable energy facilities. We should allow larger scale solar facilities to be built within cities by right and use underutilized public land for the purpose of energy generation. That doesn't mean land that would otherwise go for housing or something that we want to do with the land, but there's a lot of places that will never be housing, will never be a new building. We could use that. Or we also have a lot of public rooftops that could be used. So, and as one of the commenters said, schools are a great place to do more renewable energy generation and bring the younger generation into appreciating and understanding the value and the benefits of renewable energy. So that would be, there's a lot of school rooftops that are well underutilized in the Bay Area. We could do more. Finally, there are some fuels that will be hard to electrify in the next few years. So biogas, for example, is an underutilized resource that we produce quite a lot of in the Bay Area, and it's actually a very, it's a useful fuel for transportation among the lowest carbon fuels per mile. So that's something we could look into capturing more of and reusing right here in the Bay Area. This is probably is hard to read, but it is directly from work that the Air District did on the consumption-based inventory, sort of showing that we are doing well in some areas in the Bay Area as individuals with respect to our carbon footprint, but there's more that we can do. And our carbon footprint goes beyond the electricity that we produce and use. It's in the goods that we purchase. And so I think we added this to our report to show that there is a collective action issue and opportunity here. We can all do more in our own lives as well to reduce the carbon that we need to reduce as a world. So in conclusion, there are many people and places in the Bay Area that will benefit from a fossil-free future, from those who will have cleaner air and better health, to those who will save money by eliminating energy waste, by enjoying the stable prices of renewable energy for buildings and mobility. And of course, we'll get lots of co-benefits of doing this for our economy, for our growing clean energy and urban and clean transportation sectors, and of course from locking in an urban pattern of growth, which will, instead of sprawl, which will preserve our open spaces and improve the efficiency of our transportation system. So we believe we can show the world what's possible, demonstrate its environmental, social, and economic superiority, and watch it take off around the world. So thank you very much for hearing my talk. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Laura.
I know I did, and I didn't put it there. I'm sorry. My email address is ltam@spur.org. So
LTAM.
You can reach me that there. Normally it's on this slide.
It's
sorry.
L. Could you spell that for us?
LTAM@spur.org.
Great.
What have I just done?
And I'll take questions.
I'm happy to take questions or
from the
comments.
Board, and then any questions or comments from the public.
Yeah.
Director Hudson.
Laura, did I hear you correct that if there's underutilized site, I'll just go there.
Underutilized what, sorry?
A site or an open site in a city that you should be able to put a solar array by right?
No, it depend. I'm saying that, so we are saying that solar should be a consideration for underutilized public spaces, not places
okay.
that would otherwise be a park.
Well, you know where I'm going with it.
You should
come to my city and say that and say you support whoever's running against me. Because build by right in cities is like a red flag.
Yeah, perhaps when the context of talking about housing by right, the language
yeah.
here is a red herring, though. I don't mean that we should put housing, I don't mean that we should put solar wherever possible everywhere with no other considerations, but rather that there are a lot of places that are never going to be something else that are, and that have open rooftops and,
okay.
and sites that are industrial or perhaps would not otherwise be something else, where solar should be a consideration, and in those cases, it shouldn't be so difficult to permit solar or other renewable energy on site. It should not have to go through a challenging permitting process.
Director Ross?
Thank you. And thank you, Laura, for a great presentation. I remember when I got this in the fall, I enjoyed reading it, and I noted the water connection part of it, and I've always been spouting off about it that, you know, as you stated in here, roughly 20% of electricity use in California is the pumping and delivery of water. Does that include the heating of water too, or is it on top of that, do you think?
I think that that is just about pumping and delivery. It does not include the natural gas is used to heat water. It does not include that, that which is, of course is used in so many households. So when you add that in, it's a much bigger number, the amount of energy that is used to move, pump, treat, and heat water.
Yeah, it becomes a larger number than most people would figure. And,
yeah,
and
that's true.
I know this is supposed to be more of a synopsis than a how-to guide on everything. It would be nice to have some source where just in each idea there was more detail. And I'll just – because sometimes it just gets overwhelming. I mean, there's just – so many things on the menu to do that I think the local governments just say, oh, whatever, you know, maybe we can do that. It just becomes overwhelming for part-time public servants to then direct staff. And unless you have just an ardent staff member who is, you know, vigilant in figuring out and suggesting and putting it up there for the part-time public servants to then risk implementing at the ire or the sense of change that sometimes people are averse to. If we just kind of focused on maybe one section, like water, and in the Bay Area, because it is, when we have droughts, it's foremost on our mind. When we don't have droughts, it's foremost on our minds, apparently. Because that would be something that we could, I mean, just having recirculation pumps in houses would reduce the amount of energy used to heat water. How we can deliver water cheaper and less electricity, you know, less driven by electricity. I don't know if you means gravity fed, but that doesn't make much sense now, but there are systems that can do it. Just in that sector, I think it would be nice if somebody like Spur could come up with how you could cut into that very large electricity usage number that's just associated with water. And, you know, that is just a prime target. And the second thing I'll say is what you ended with was the consumption-based profile. And this is totally different. It's the other evil twin, other unspoken thing that most public servants, part-time public servants, do not want to engage in, and a lot of community organizations kind of back away from, is that if you get them to say, well, maybe we shouldn't be buying gas. Oh, that's good, you know, refineries aren't going to say that. We can't expect them to say that. But, you know, if you don't want people to be overweight by eating too much ice cream, you tell them, well, don't eat so much ice cream. And I think that somewhere there has to be somebody that steps up and says, it's consumption-based, That means there's consumers involved in the demand. And maybe the governmental organizations aren't the ones that are going to be able to do that by themselves, that organizations like SPUR, which I greatly respect. And I think I'm still a member. I don't know if I paid you the last year, but might be very helpful in that, and I'll get off my soapbox, but helping to drive down that consumer purchase of the items that are causing the issues might be helpful. Thank you.
Thanks for your comments.
We're looking up your dues information right now.
Director Sinks, if I could say something
quickly.
So I think that so the plan will come to the board for consideration in April, but then there's the implementation of it. And I think that the best practices idea that you were mentioning, working with SPUR and other organizations, I mean, that's what we're going to be looking at. How do we engage with others, nonprofits, other agencies, local, state, regional, to think about how to implement the aspects of this plan that are not, you know, there's the regulations, the control measures, but then there's all these other things that are sort of more best practice oriented. So we'll be connecting with SPUR and others to figure out who's going to work on these things. How do we work on them together? So it's a good point.
And Director Rice.
Thank you, Laura, for the presentation and for the work that SPUR's doing. Two questions. One, I'm concerned about the California waiver with regards to mileage standards. Yeah. And I don't know how feasible it is that actually is going to be successfully attacked. But I'm wondering if you have any comments or if any thinking's been done on what that might do in terms of impacting our ability to really address address the fleet, and if the fleet's going to change here in California in terms of getting at those passenger vehicle GHGs. And then secondly, if you could talk about increasing the energy efficiency in our existing building stock. We're really counting on that. And yes, SB 350 exists, but I think that's going to be a really tough nut to crack. So talk a little bit about that as well.
Sure. On the waiver piece, I think there are other people here who might be better qualified to address it, although suffice it to say I share your angst. Would you like to take the waiver?
We can start, and I'll have Damien add to my remarks. We have recently corresponded with EPA raising that same concern that California needs to maintain its waiver. And for the board members, what the waiver does is it allows essentially California to go above and beyond the standards that are set by EPA because of our air pollution problem. So we can establish more stringent standards, and they have typically availed themselves of that waiver for historical reasons for a long time now. We too share your concern that it might get attacked, and there's apparently some discussion going on about that because the automakers have already gone to the Trump administration asking for there to be only one set of standards for all the states. So that's a real concern of ours.
And it's significant because it's the California waiver, and we have taken advantage of it in terms of raising our mileage standards, but other states have piggybacked on that. I forget the number of how many millions of people cars are actually cleaner because of that California waiver.
I think it's 12 states that use the same standard. Just to be clear, it's the emission standard. So the mileage standard is a separate issue, and we don't have a waiver for that. But the emission standard is very important to California.
Is it fair to say that that's also brought us the EV vehicles that we've gotten?
That's a state mandate that's separate from the
Our advanced clean cars mandate has brought that to us. So it's taken the emissions down, and it essentially equates to a fuel usage by 2020 of over 40 miles per gallon per vehicle. But it's actually based on emissions. They do it in grams per brake horsepower. Particular regulation also sets a target for electric vehicles of 15.4% of all fleet in California by the year 2025. So it's kind of difficult to understand it. When EPA does standards, they set them similar to us in emission standards, but they work with the the Highway Transportation Board to set the CAFE standards, which is the average mileage for the fleet. That was set to be by 2025 nationwide up on 52 miles per gallon. And what's happened is, in our discussions with the automakers, they've said, well, you know, we've invested in California, we've invested in going down a particular technology path. What they've said to us is, and whether this proves true or not, we're about to find out. They want a review of the actions that were taken under the previous, under the Obama administration, and possibly to slide the target out, not abandon it altogether. So we'll see. We've written to Administrator Pruitt to express that to him. I'm expecting a response any day now. But
we got a response, but it's a finger.
So we'll have to see how true those words are. But in California, the bell kind of has been rung, and people, I think, you know, if you've got 3% of your fleet already electric, it's going to be hard to pull back from that. And you see that the utilities and all of these other folks are coming forward with larger infrastructure programs for both private, light-duty and heavy-duty vehicles. So I think at least in this state, we'll be moving forward, and we'll see what happens nationally.
So if I get this right, the federal government could choose to prevent us from having the waiver that helps us drive the industry overall, but if we wanted to continue to push EVs in the state, we're doing so under a state law mandate.
We could. I think Brian will weigh in here to talk about the legal precedent for the waiver. Do you want to comment on that?
So the current debate is whether the existing California waiver goes forward, and so far the move has not been made to revoke that. There actually is no mechanism to revoke it. So once granted, the Clean Air Act doesn't say you can take it away. So that would be unprecedented. All but one time in history, the waiver that we requested has been granted. That one time was reversed when the Obama administration came into being. So the Bush administration had declined to approve the vehicle standard that implemented Pavley, the emission standard that implemented the Pavley bill. And at that point, California sued, and out of that came a resolution that included changing the CAFE standard, the corporate average fuel economy standard, and also allowed California to set the greenhouse gas standard in its emission standard. So that happened about 9 years ago now, give or take, maybe a little bit less than that because there was some negotiation period. That standard, I think, rolls forward to 2025. The California standard, and we are in the process of setting a new standard and requesting a new waiver. That one is more at risk, I think, than undoing the existing waiver. So that's sort of the state of play at the moment. There's a process for granting the waiver. Once the waiver is granted, other states can get Me Too waivers, which is why we have about a dozen states or so who implement the California standard, and it's the bulk of the American public, I think, that drives vehicles that meet the California standard, or the bulk of the public lives in places where the vehicles available meet the California standard.
Pretty much those blue states.
Yeah, but coastal areas.
And the Northeast. I did want to just mention to you, because a number of you were at the Budget and Finance Committee, that's why we set aside $500,000 for litigation, by the way, in the next year's budget, thinking that we may need to be able to join other organizations, other states on this point.
Interesting. And so has there been any talk of the federal tax rebate on EVs being eliminated? And is that part of a budget or?
That again would be an action by the federal government, and they grant that every 3 years, so it would be on the slate for review again. Yeah. So everything is, you know, I think it is on the table with this new administration. We'll have to see how the budget goes. They do, it looks like, have a preference for tax cuts. So that may play in our favor. what we've been hearing so far, though, hasn't been too encouraging.
Thank you. I had a couple of questions for you, Laura. Oh,
yeah,
go ahead.
I didn't
yeah.
get to. I would like to answer your question on existing
yeah,
buildings,
please.
Which is that you know there. Yes, I think this is one of the biggest challenges, and there's a lot of ways to do it. And as we were talking about the federal waiver just now, I was reminded that a lot of the way that we have hinged our existing building retrofit programs at the local level is on Energy Star Portfolio Manager. And so I don't know what the future of that is, but that's what we do in San Francisco. We have buildings, I think over 40,000 square feet, have to benchmark their energy use in an Energy Star Portfolio Manager. They don't have to implement identified identified cost-effective improvements, but that's something that could be done. There's also a lot of resources available through Energy Upgrade California for retrofits, and I think that there is not as much uptake of those rebates as there could be. So again, the public engagement question is something that we need to do to sort of deepen the impact of doing more retrofits. But it's energy efficiency is a tricky art. Every building is different. Every building has different challenges with respect to upgrades. And so there are a couple of examples that we point to in the report of good ideas that I'd be happy to follow up with you on. But there are promising things being done in some cities to try to push the envelope with respect to how you do it. I know in Berkeley, too, there's been an ordinance requiring buildings to retrofit on resale, which hasn't worked as well in San Francisco, but it's something that keeps the building stock evolving.
Well, I think what's missing or what we need at the local government level is it's one thing to adopt trigger that requires something, but we don't have the information, I think, that would be helpful to property owners about the cost and the trade-offs and where to invest the monies, even over, you know, having a longer term plan. I mean, we're going to get a negative reaction from folks if they're required to, whether it's at point of sale or what have you, but potentially to have tools and information and context of ways to get there, so it's not just this abstract. You've got to retrofit. You've got, you know, change out your energy devices, or is it insulator? Is it what have you? But there's no toolkit there. There's no metrics. So it's this vast unknown that sounds like it could be super expensive. And a pain in the ass, excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't start with homes either, right? You would start with, like, bigger commercial buildings, and you would provide incentives, and you could finance it through PACE, or there's a toolkit. But I think you may be correct that the toolkit isn't clearly put together in some way. We list a bunch of the top of the ideas as bullets, but making that into a more of a workbook might be helpful. It's a good idea.
A couple of questions. you started by talking about renewable, and you ended it near the end. You talked about decarbonizing the grid, and I will tell you, having been engaged to bring Silicon Valley clean energy into existence, we wrestled with this question: should we prioritize being 100% carbon-free from the get-go, which was our ultimate decision on our base rate, or should we be looking to up the renewables? And, you know, for us, it came down to, well, we need an always-on source. Half of our electricity will be from big hydro to start with. That's not renewable per the state's RPS. An alternative could have been, okay, let's put a bunch of money into storage to augment solar to help that duck curve. Do you have a perspective on where our, as community choice energy organizations, or otherwise working in municipal utilities, where our priorities should be and why?
That's a great question. I would say that there's, you know, it's a balance for every community choice organization. You're trying to balance reliability, affordability, what your customers are willing to purchase in terms of options with the percentage of green energy or how you even define the green energy. I know it's different depending on which CCA it is. So I think a lot of it has to do with what will make the program viable and can keep customers staying with the program. Mm-hmm. So with, and it's different depending on where you are. I think Marin has a higher tolerance, for example, perhaps for more expensive energy that is perhaps more has more of those green attributes. But I would love to talk with you more about it.
It's something we wrestled with, and we said, well, we could take PG&E 60% carbon free and make it only 80% and add more renewables in, but you know, some of this stuff costs more. If we are going to add storage at this time to solar, there's a big cost associated with that, so we can't bring all the benefits at once. We elected ultimately, we found we could be a little bit less than PG&E across the board and be 100% carbon free, so that was our immediate priority, and then we have an opt-up, right? But that's another 3 or 5% in cost, and so we made that decision. But I think all of us are sort of struggling with, okay, how do we reconcile these two different metrics that we could be?
Yeah, and how do you engage the public in making a choice around it, especially when right. PG&E's option is pretty carbon free as it is? There's a little bit of a challenge to getting people to pay more, willingness to pay more.
Yes, it's easy to talk about paying less, which I think is why all of us have been on that line. And then, okay, how can you optimize otherwise given that constraint? At least at the base rate. You talked about plug load, and you said it was 2/3 of... I didn't quite understand all of that. I wonder if you could elaborate just a bit.
Sure. Plug load is, all the devices that are that we plug in, and
computers.
It's generally about 2/3 of household electricity use. So it's a large number, but it's hard to know what the demand is because it's something that people control. It's not regulated in a way.
It's things that have two or three prongs.
Yeah, anything. It's any electricity device that we plug into
the phantom load that when the device is off, it's always drawing a little bit of current.
Got it.
But it's not just that's true, but it's also just the fact that we have so many more electronic devices than we used to. So you have things plugged in that are charging, whether or not they're charging. Like we use a lot of rechargeable devices now than we used to, and so it's the fastest growing percent like thing within household electricity.
Does the state have any regulation that would encourage manufacturers building power supplies for all these devices to ensure a very low steady state?
I don't believe that
standby
the state
current?
Can be involved in it. It's a federally regulated. Somebody else could correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a federally regulated.
It is, huh?
Standard. It's not something that the state can do okay. anything about. In fact, they're not allowed to, if I'm correct. The state can't preempt the federal requirements.
And one final comment. I really appreciated the Zanke chart that connects the energy sources with uses. I think that's really enlightening because it connects. Okay, it's easy to talk about refineries, but okay, there's actually something that we do, right, that creates the demand for those refineries. So I'm much in appreciation for this figure.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Wondered if there's comments from the public.
I have Greg Karras, Janet Stromberg, and Jed Holtzman.
Thank you.
3 minutes each.
So, Chairman, Committee. Greg Karras, CBE. I'm going to speak to one of Laura's slides. First, I wanted to say that it's notable that something that CBE and researchers in the scientific community, like Williams et al., E3, and Jacobson have been saying for years, that we have to make deep cuts in GHG emissions. We have to start now. That it's feasible to do it if we start now. And I'm really happy to see Spur joining us and also your staff with the first couple chapters of their Clean Air Plan joining us. That's good news. We hope it's not too late. I wanted to speak to the top sources of emissions slide just to make a couple of examples of where the Spur analysis needs to go further. It's a table, the top sources of emissions. And so sort of to start off with this while the table gets up there, the you're talking about what the state can do with vehicles if the feds pull the plug on the vehicle standards under the Commerce Clause or whatever. I want to point out that there's an environmental injustice still going on in the East Bay that you're all a part of in a way. On 880, heavy-duty diesel trucks are allowed, not 580. So if you flip that around, you have an example here in the Bay Area where you've just said, hey, here's a road where a certain kind of vehicle can't be. There's a report that in China they sold about a million EVs in Beijing last year. How did they do it? They said, well, you only get this many licenses to drive in the city with a petroleum-powered car, but you can get a bunch. You can get a license for an electric car. In San Francisco here, you'll see places where at certain times of day you can't drive your truck because it's too crowded. There's safety reasons. There's lots of reasons why you could take action. This recommendation isn't in any of these reports, but if you really wanted to, you guys could go for it in your cities and your counties in this region. And so I wanted to make another broader critique. This needs to be added to your plan, and I'd recommend it be added to SPRS analysis. You heard Laura say that you build a fossil plant today, it'll be running for 40 years. 40 years from today, what year is that? We have to stop building them now. That's fossil fuel infrastructure. That's why refineries are exporting gasoline when we reduce consumption. That's why they're going to dirtier, cheaper oil for those exports.
Time.
And that's why the electricity generation is bottlenecked because there aren't enough batteries to even out the load to make us decarbonized. So look at infrastructure inertia. Take it seriously, because if you don't, it will be too late.
Thank you, Greg.
Janet Stromberg, 350 Bay Area. I was very happy to see SPRS slide 6 that draws attention to the health benefits of going fossil free, which has definitely been in the Air District's information for years and years, except not this explicitly. And it is actually a comment that we made for the Clean Air Plan, is to show what fossil free, how it would impact actual health. Slide 8, I actually want to quote, natural gas boilers, heaters, and chillers are combined second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, with little being done to directly reduce natural gas use or shift demand to fossil fuel sources. I note that the draft Clean Air Plan's stationary source strategy specifically includes improved combustion efficiency at the largest sources, reducing methane emissions, and reducing toxic air contaminant emissions. The stationary source strategy includes no specific goal of reducing greenhouse gases and particulate emissions, despite those causing the greatest social and public health costs to the region. There's also no mention in the stationary source strategy of the need to, in the words of SPR, shift demand to non-fossil fuel sources. Furthermore, the plan states that it uses an all feasible measures approach to the ozone plan. If that's the case, aggressive decarbonization must also be part of the ozone plan, and therefore core to the stationary source strategy. So our two key recommendations on the stationary source strategy are, one, it should explicitly include decarbonization and reducing combustion as a way to reduce all pollutants, but particularly particulates and greenhouse gases. And two, the stationary source strategy should include mid-size and smaller sources in the near term, not just the largest ones. Combustion reduction solutions for small and mid-size sources are more readily available and quicker to implement. We've made a few suggestions of some decarbonization. We also think that the air districts who'd engage, it's dozens and dozens of air quality engineers, of whom I used to be one, in finding additional solutions, because they're the ones that know the 8,000 facilities that they permit. They know where the opportunities are, and if they spend a little time doing some research, they might actually be able to provide some demonstration projects. We also think that facility operators need to be part engaged and part of a long-range strategy, and that goes to the comment we made about having stakeholder ongoing engagement. We think that that needs to include the operators of the mid-sized stationary sources and the small ones. Thank you.
Hello again, Jed Holtzman from 350 Bay Area. I want to thank SPUR for this inspiring vision. I moved to San Francisco in 1999, so I'm very familiar with SPUR's work locally, and it's great to see such a august group describing a fossil-free Bay Area in matter-of-fact terms. Obviously, a fossil-free Bay Area is something that we work towards every day at 350 Bay Area. This report really dovetails heavily with the Clean Air Plan and staff's work on the Clean Air Plan, as well as 350 Bay Area's comments on the plan to strengthen it. I think since 2013, we've been haranguing staff about decarbonization and electrification. It's very well represented in the Regional Climate Protection Strategy. And I think most of what's mentioned here in the SPUR plan is, the SPUR report is addressed by the control measures in the Clean Air Plan, if we can fully implement them and robustly. And that's a real question to us, as you'll continue to hear. If you could go back to the top sources slide, which Greg talked about, I just wanted to highlight, this is a comment that we made in the Clean Air Plan, ultimately you see passenger cars and trucks amounting to 28.5 million metric tons. That accounts for about 15 million vehicles on the road. And those 15 million vehicles are not subject to air district regulation. Right under that, you see refineries at 14.2. That is five facilities, five, accounting for 14.2 versus 15 million, accounting for 28.5. I might also add those five fall under your regulation and that you've been regulating them for decades. So to us, it seems that these kinds of sources are really the low-hanging fruit, and we would note that the Air District has had trouble even committing to prevent GHG increases at these facilities, thus the EPIC 1216/13-1 struggle for many years now, much less reducing them. And certainly, we're looking at control measures in the Clean Air Plan that will start to hopefully reduce them. But the Air District has not, from our perspective, attacked the low-hanging fruit. And this this data from SPUR kind of just amplifies our point from our comments. If we're not going to make reductions here at the Air District, at the facilities that you've been regulating for decades, then where are we really going to effectively do this? The last thing that we would say is, again, made this comment in our report on the plan, but this talks about reducing combustion over time, and I think the Air District's framework is more focused on increasing efficiency of combustion. I think the vision for 2050 clearly calls for no combustion, or very little. But we need to start getting there immediately, and a longer glide path for industry would be more appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Jed. Any other speakers? No. Thank you. Bring it back here for any closing comments. I was interested in Janet Stromberg's comment. She talked about demo projects and small and medium-sized sources. Is this something our technology office might be working on? Could you comment?
I think that's exactly what that office is aimed at doing. We've had, down through the years, numerous of these projects. We are meeting with some folks actually in the next few weeks to talk about, you know, carbon sequestration and all of these types of things that could be done, things that are being done at facilities right now that could be transferred across industries. So that's the focus of the technology implementation office. You know, And, you know, there is an idea. I think one of our first things, and we've outlaid this for the board, is that we do want to take a look at, across the board, what are the best available control technologies that we could do for greenhouse gases right now. And in that there's probably a big, broad pool there, but we're looking for ones that are low cost that could be implemented in numerous different applications, and that's kind of the first and primary focus of the TAO as we constitute it.
I mean, so for example, if I have solar on my roof, I'm generating a lot of electricity in excess of my demand, and it happens that my water heater seems to happen every decade or so, goes out. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's an alternative appliance that I could be replacing with instead of just putting in.
Yeah, and there's probably a grant available for you, or PACE or PG&E. There's numerous programs out there that can help you with that.
Okay.
There's even, you know, we talked about a little bit about the regional weatherization program from ABAG that came up today. It's connecting all of those things together.
Thank you. More comments? If not, we'll move on to item 5.
Yes, Chair Sings and members of the committee. Abby Young, our Climate Protection Program Manager, will give a presentation. This one today will focus on air district support for local governments and the local government's climate protection activities. She'll give a little bit of history on that and where we are now and things that are in the Clean Air Plan that will amplify that.
Thank you, Vice Chair Sinks and board members. And I was going to say good morning, but I'll say good afternoon. Well, as Jean mentioned, I am going to talk about how the Air District has worked with local governments in our pursuit of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the Bay Area and how we view that partnership and collaboration moving forward. So just to remind us of some background, back in 2005, our advisory council studied the issue of climate protection and greenhouse gas mitigation and climate change and how all these things interacted with our air quality program and how climate change impacted and impacts air quality and public health in the Bay Area. And so through that study and their analysis, they recommended that the board establish a formal climate protection program here at the Air District, and the board did. So launched the program in 2005 and formed this committee to oversee that program. And from the very beginning, we really realized that working very closely to support local climate planning and greenhouse gas mitigation and working with local governments in particular was going to have to be a cornerstone of that program because local governments, you know, directly control or greatly influence so many activities and choices and behaviors that occur at the community level that impact the carbon intensity of our communities, that we really saw local governments as a critical player and key driver of the program. So in shaping this climate protection program and thinking about working with local governments, so back at that time, there were only a handful of communities in the Bay Area that had adopted climate action plans. And so we shaped some of our early support and focused it on helping more local governments embrace climate action planning and developing the long-term policies and strategies to achieve their own greenhouse gas reduction targets. And it was clear that there were some pretty specific and obvious barriers to many local governments pursuing the climate action planning route. And two of the biggest ones were staff availability to work on this issue and staff expertise in the area of greenhouse gas, you know, knowledge, quantification, and climate planning in general. So we did a number of things to try to facilitate and to try to build up that capacity and expertise. We convened county-based trainings on how to conduct greenhouse gas emissions inventories. We worked with different data providers like PG&E and MTC to try to facilitate data provision and make it more accessible and usable. We developed our own guidance on how to develop strong climate action plans, including CEQA guidance on how to develop plans that might enable streamlining down the road. And then in 2007, the Air District's reserves were strong, and the board made a decision to invest in some climate protection grants. So we initiated a one-time $3 million climate protection grant program. And I think it's important to note that at the time that we did this in 2007, it was the largest grant program in the country that with the sole focus of climate protection and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So we developed the program, and we again wanted to focus on at the community level. So we had about 52, I think, grants, fairly small, ranging from about $20,000 to $70,000 in all counties of the Bay Area. Most of them went to local governments. A good number also went to local nonprofits doing community-based work. And I'll talk a little bit more about those in the next slide. A couple years later, through a settlement with ConocoPhillips, we were able to invest in a new climate grant program, again, looking at public agencies and communities, this time to very specifically fund the deployment of energy efficiency and renewable energy technologies. And after that, or right about that time, we started creating our long-term strategy for switching the region over to electric vehicles. And since about 2010, we've invested over $17 million in the Bay Area, largely in electric vehicle charging infrastructure. So we've really come at this in a variety of ways. So I wanted to just kind of reflect on those grant programs and think about what did we gain long term. So referring back to that $3 million program, one thing we did was we funded about 20 local climate action plans. And so when we combined those climate action plans with the handful that had already been adopted at that time, we really created a critical mass of community-based climate action plans. And that established or sort of created a culture of climate action planning in the Bay Area. It became a more common thread of community planning. And we started to see some standardization across how these plans were developed and a lot more information sharing and communication across local governments that were working on these plans, implementing these plans, and developing these plans. Cool. We also, in that grant program, funded several permanent staff positions in, I think it was about seven local governments. And the idea behind this was to help develop permanent staffing capacity to continue doing climate action planning and implementation over the long term. We realized that staffing was a big barrier, and so we thought, well, how can we use a small amount of money to have a long-term impact? So we provided what was about half the cost of 1 year of a staff person. And these staff people often will help implement energy-saving measures that save money, and they will also apply for grants to forward their program's goals. And so those were ways that we viewed that these positions could self-fund in the future if they just had that kickoff funding. And it's interesting to note that though those staffing positions were funded in 2007, right before the recession, nearly all of them continue today. So we think that that was a pretty successful decision. And their fingerprints are on a lot of the most successful coordinating programs in the Bay Area. The San Mateo County RICAPS program, which stands for the Regionally Integrated Climate Action Planning Suite, Sonoma County's Coordinated Climate Action Planning Effort, the Marin Climate and Energy Partnership, where they have one staff person that updates all the jurisdiction's plans. So there were are a lot of ways that these staffing positions have had a long-term lasting impact. We also focused on funding innovation and innovative ideas, and a couple big game changers came out of that grant program. We funded, provided startup funding for the Marin Clean Energy Program, and we also funded the first property assessed clean energy program, or PACE program, with Berkeley First. So, you know, sometimes communities have great ideas, but they just need that startup funding to try to put them. And also, you know, innovation isn't just technology-based. It can also be policy innovation. And we recently conducted a survey of local government staff to try to get a sense of where have been the successes and the challenges in implementing their climate protection programs. And electric vehicle programs seem to be one of the consistently successful types of programs that communities are implementing. And, you know, we think that part of that is because of the incentive programs that the Air District has been providing. So with this slide, I just wanted to throw out a kind of a variety of metrics to see where we are today with our climate action in the Bay Area. So we have about 65 adopted climate action plans, and while that means that there are probably about 50 jurisdictions that don't have adopted plans, they're all in the works. This is more than any other metropolitan region in the country, so that's exciting. We have four community, I believe, it happens so quickly, by now it could be five, community choice energy programs established, with a couple more coming this year, and I think a final one which will end up covering the entire Bay Area next year. So that's exciting. We have multiple electric vehicle funding programs. We just launched the 2017 Charge program, and to date have funded over 1,300 charging stations, which I think is nearly 20% of the charging infrastructure in the Bay Area. The woman who gave public comment this morning, who spoke to us a few months ago about the Kyoto USA program, mentioned the solar on schools, and it's been mentioned by some of you as well this morning. We had a good partnership with Kyoto USA that we're continuing to pursue in helping schools and school districts use their rooftop spaces to install solar to gain control over their energy supply, to save money in the long run and build some learning and teaching opportunities for their students. And I really appreciated the gentleman in the public comment this morning who spoke to the youth education. And I think that this is extremely important in achieving our long-term goals. Youth is a growing component of not just our public outreach and our education, but it's also a growing component of leadership on this issue. And so this is going to be increasingly important as we move forward. Events like our YES program are very important, and local governments themselves have a direct role in this through their county departments of education, the school districts, as well as the many community and education programs that they fund. Now, our clean air plan, Spare the Air, Cool the Climate, certainly depends largely on a good collaboration and success at the local level. There are some areas in the plan in which the implementation really relies a lot on local government action, and indeed where local governments often have a more direct role to affect greenhouse gas emissions than the Air District does. So certainly in the areas, many of which Laura mentioned in her presentation, green buildings, land use and trip reduction, energy efficiency, local renewable energy, but also public outreach, waste. These are all traditional areas that local governments have a very direct role. And so the Air District wants to support and facilitate and accelerate those local activities as much as we can with the tools that we have. So as we look to the future, some things that we have on the horizon. We're currently working with leaders of some of the community choice energy programs to convene a meeting, probably in April, of community energy programs and key stakeholders to talk about how the Air District can support the continued work and expansion of these programs. Excuse me. We're also working with the Bay Area Regional Collaborative and ABAG's BayREN program to launch a model solar ordinance program, which will create a solar ordinance and toolkit for local governments to adopt. And of course, we're looking to work with local governments in new policy areas. And these are areas, again, buildings, transportation, and land use, where local governments often play a very key and direct role. One area in which we've been, thank you so much. That helps. One area in which we've been contributing is providing regular updates on state funding opportunities and programs to local government climate staff. And we've heard directly from climate staff that this is something that they hope the Air District can continue to do and improve the streamlining and delivery of this information. And then another common request we get is help. We need help updating our climate plans. We want to do it, but it requires so much time and data, and the data doesn't come easily and in the right format. So we're trying to work in every way that we can to help in that regard. And we're about to launch a webcast, launching a new tool that we've developed with MTC to help deliver plan-ready transportation data for local government staff. And then, of course, we're launching our technology implementation office, and that may have some good assistance available to local governments, especially in some of the areas already talked about this morning, battery storage, heat pumps, new technologies. We've proposed a $4.5 million new grant program in the upcoming fiscal year budget to fund, again, local community level greenhouse gas mitigation programs. And to develop this program, we are going to reach out to local governments, community organizations, and other business networks and other stakeholder groups to find out where are their funding gaps, how can funding today influence emission reductions far into the future so that we can develop a smart and strategic funding program that focuses on innovation, produces investments in projects that can be replicable, yield a lot of co-benefits, and continue to demonstrate leadership. And we envision that that program will help accelerate the implementation of climate action plans, invest in the most impacted communities, and leverage, of course, all the important resources that already exist in the Bay Area. And to wrap up, this, as we've been hearing all morning, this is an enormous challenge that lies before us. But we believe that with all these resources here in the Bay Area, and with strong collaboration with local governments, we can work together and we can begin moving down that pathway to the vision for 2050. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Abby. Appreciate that. Comments?
Yeah. What's that second bullet?
Our wonderful dedicated elected officials.
I'm half joking about it, but I don't know what it is about us, the elected officials, but it seems like we get it at different times, and wow, do things change depending on what time of the year it is and whether that year ends in an even number. I hope that we really stay on this dedicated official part, because I'm going to be doing a speech in front of the Information Technology Summit, and to me, I see that as part of the problem. I mean, we went out for an election, you see the ones that fail. And yeah, we're behind you 100%. We don't have a sign up in our yard, but I mean, we're behind you 100%. And I think that's going to be a key part of everything we're trying to do, whether or not we're getting lip service or we're truly behind what you're trying to do.
Thank you. Mark, Director Abby Coca.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Looking at the history, I think our community has taken a lot of your resources to take an advantage of that. We have staff, and we're pretty far along on all these check boxes. But our community is very dedicated, and lately they've been advocating for more measurements more often. And talking with our county at a regional level, I realize all our communities are in different places. And so my sense is what we could use is one, assistance in doing those benchmarking and measurements and whatnot, and also then collaborating, and not so that we can just replicate and you know, share, be efficient, and not have to start from scratch everywhere. Those would be areas that I would be interested in, I guess, putting your next resources into, and hope that you might be able to support that.
Yeah, I would second that. It recently came up that we had several meetings where we've discussed this at Silicon Valley Clean Energy, who exactly should be conducting these greenhouse gas inventories. Ought it be done on each city's level, or should the energy agency take this on? It's, you know, it's certainly related to our program, and yet we know that this is a regional, if not a global problem, and is it something the Air District should be doing? And we could use some help, guidance, thinking about, yeah, the appropriate level. I mean, the benefit of local government is maybe there's more access, people, there becomes more awareness in our community when we chat this up at council meetings. And on the other hand, you know, if there are 15 cities in Santa Clara County alone, and each of us are having to do this and our methodologies are different, I'm kind of wondering if it might not make more sense to be coordinating and conducting this on a regional level. I know Advisory Council is talking about projects where you'd fly over and look at hot spots, and so that's another level, and you know, our borders are political, not physical in that sense, right, with regard to pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. So I think we need some help or some discussion to try to sort out things like that. So are there any public speakers on this item?
Greg Karras and Lisa Chang Mason.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, let's do that.
Greg Karras, CBE. Very happy to be strongly supporting the staff's recommendation and some of your comments. I want to say a couple of things about why we think you can justify it and perhaps have to do it. You're required to come up with a series of measures that are going to protect our health and climate. State implementation plan, the Clean Air Plan, you know, that does that. Like your staff said, with your climate plan, a whole bunch of those measures rely on local communities to do the heavy lifting. You got to pay for it. And, you know, I probably don't have to tell you this, but the local communities are pretty cash-strapped. This district has unique regional authority to collect fees for climate and air quality protection. Mm-hmm. If you want the locals to do half or more of your work, got to pay them. And that means us and the NGAs too. It's true, as Director Abby Koga, as you said, it's true communities are different. In Richmond, where CBE and others have been actively building resources and capacity for what we call a just transition for a long time, participated directly in the Energy and Climate Plan, the first one in Richmond, the type the staff mentioned. We've been doing this for years. we're facing a situation where we can't get enough solar, as much solar build out as the city wants, because it can't afford it without cutting staff, literally, right now. And that's before the federal administration does what it's going to do. In our community, we have a concentration of fossil industry jobs that in decades need to be transitioned. We know it's not going to be just magic that those jobs go to the clean energy jobs and that stays in our community without local action. So we actually do need that money in order to have the social acceptance to be able to buy the electric cars and stop using gasoline, right? And Director Hudson, I actually agree with you that it's really important that there be local control over things like, what do we do with our open space? Every community I've worked in working with community members trying to site clean energy, including and especially here in South Potrero Hill and Hunter's Point, when we were working with Laura when she was at the city of San Francisco to replace the power plants here with clean energy, we found that it was essential that the community make its own decisions. So you need us. If you're going to make us do the work, got to pay us for it. Raise those fees. Expand them to actually be up to the task. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg.
Hello, I'm Lisa Chang Mason, so thank you for letting me speak again, and thank you for your work in supporting the local communities. And I just kind of wanted to speak a little bit about my own local community. I live in Alamo, and last night, I attended a town meeting held by our state senator, Steve Glazer, and our state assemblyperson, Catherine Baker. And it was a huge venue at the Leisure Center. It was just packed. And there were three questions and comments from the general public about climate and environment. And I was so interested to see there were more comments about that than there were about immigration and ACA and Russia. And every time someone made a comment supporting scientists or, you know, protesting the rollbacks at the EPA, the crowd erupted in, you know, applause and cheers, you know. And I also had an experience being at the Women's March in Walnut Creek. And, you know, it's not an area that's known to be a political hotbed or environmental, you know, grassroots, you know, powerhouse. And there were people signing up from, it was amazing to me, you know, Clayton and Concord and Antioch and Brentwood and Bay Point and, you know, Pittsburgh, Livermore, Pleasanton, Alamo, Danville, you know, La Mirinda. And I just kind of was getting the feeling that there's this tremendous kind of upwelling of support and activism. Maybe people like myself who were kind of assuming everything was going to be going okay and we didn't really need to speak up. And I just kind of see it as a demonstration that there's the political will out there to support this, even out in an area that's not San Francisco or Marin or Oakland, Berkeley. And it was really cool to see Catherine Baker, who's a Republican, talk about how she didn't want her children to have to grow up in a world that was ruined by climate change. And so on a last personal note, we bought a Chevy Bolt 3 weeks ago, and it's got 238-mile, you know, range. And it's like the most fun little car. And as I'm driving around town, I'm just getting so much interest, and people are so excited about it because it's kind of fun and, you know, wonderful. And I didn't realize until today how much I owed to this group for all the rebates we got and all the nice charging stations around town. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I feel your excitement. Any other board comments? I was curious to know how much we helped Marin Clean Energy back in the day.
It was, Abby, do you remember the amount? 75 maybe?
Yeah, we granted $70,000. They had already done a couple of the initial studies. And so I think what it did was it enabled dedicated staff time to work on developing the program.
I would say it must be one of the best investments ever this air district has ever made.
Yeah,
because we've copied what Marin has done, all of us now.
I note regularly when when Marine Clean Energy is raised here and the Air District's investment, because I knew that that number was, and I also know how much money the county put in 2 years and years of making it come to fruition. Excellent return on investment for the Air District.
Yeah, so obviously you all in Marin did marvelous things to make that go. Great. Any more comments on 5? If not, we'll move to item 6, committee member comments. I will note that if you're not here for our advisory council meeting on Monday, the 3rd of April, you can come down to Cupertino Community Hall, where we will be toggling the switch on our community choice energy program, Silicon Valley Clean Energy, noon, Monday 4-3 at Cupertino Community Hall. And we are commencing service. We will be enrolling much of Silicon Valley, and then in July, we have our second phase, and at that point, other than for solar customers, which will come in at their true update, we'll have 11 cities in the unincorporated county as our customers. So that's my announcement. And with that, if there are no others, we will convene our next meeting as scheduled on May 18th at 9:30 a.m. here at Beale Street, and this meeting is adjourned.